Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Welcome back to Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again. My name is John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. Today's interview is completely different than anything I've ever done, and I'm really, really happy to bring it to you today. But there's no hack, there's no proper really start to the interview, but there is a solid conclusion, and I think you're really, really, really going to get inspired and love this interview. Today's guest is an absolute legend of entrepreneurism, philanthropy, and perseverance, and I want to thank Emma Sinclair for the introduction and making this happen. My guest was born in Germany in 1933. This is her first podcast interview ever. This was the year the Nazis came to power. She fled to Britain at the age of 6 as a kinder transport refugee, one of 10,000 Jewish children whose parents sent them away to escape persecution. She was raised by a couple in England that took her and her sister in. As a girl with a passion for mathematics, she studied voraciously and had a thirst for knowledge. It was during this time that she decided to make her life a life worth saving. And that's exactly what she did. After dealing with endless bouts of sexism and not being allowed to get ahead in her career, she had an idea. She decided to start her own company selling software. That doesn't sound controversial today. And it's not today, but it sounded absolutely crazy 50 years ago. With just £6, she set up her business from the dining room table. That was 1962, and she was 29 years old. The company was freelance programmers, and mainly because of the workplace misogyny she had faced, she employed only women software specialists. And, even more shocking for the time, women working from home. Given her experience with previous employers, it was not unreasonable to speculate that many potential customers seeing the word Stephanie Shirley at the bottom of a letter would simply refuse to take proposals seriously because she was a woman. Her husband suggested testing this theory by signing a few letters Steve Shirley instead. She did this, and people began to respond. She has now been Steve ever since. Steve Shirley went on to create a multi-billion dollar IT software consultancy, the F1 Group, from which she made a fortune, hundreds of millions of dollars. Since retiring in 1993, she has devoted her life to autism research, and she has given away most of her wealth. She has won countless awards and accreditations and truly is an inspiration to everyone, entrepreneurs included. Now, let's get to the conversation with Dame Stephanie Shirley. I want to take a minute and thank today's sponsor, FreshBooks. As we just finished the end of the year and now we head into tax season, I am so thankful for having FreshBooks, for keeping my bookkeeping organized and being able to just now send off reports to my accountant. If you in small business or out there have been audited before, it is a nightmare. And usually when I got audited, I think it was about 5 years ago, it was terrible in the fact that I was so disorganized that it cost me so much money for what I had to pay because I just hadn't done my bookkeeping right. And FreshBooks has now allowed me to completely change that in a simplified way. FreshBooks directly integrates with the way I take money online, which is PayPal and which is Stripe, and then how I do my email with MailChimp to my customers. It fully integrates. I can send invoices and get paid directly to my PayPal or Stripe. For us small business and solo entrepreneurs online, FreshBooks is a godsend. To start your free 30-day trial today, go to freshbooks.com/hack. And don't forget to enter Hack the Entrepreneur in the How Did You Hear About Us section. As I was reading, especially the first couple chapters of your book, I was like, well, it almost feels like the wrong part of the story to talk about, but because you've had such a dramatic life, you've had so many stories, and now we're going to talk about as you set up the business, but the business obviously then allowed you to do a lot of things since then.
When people talk about business, they tend to think in terms of economic indicators and how much investment and angel investors and all this sort of thing. Whereas I think the most important thing about entrepreneurism is motivation and the character of the person that's doing it and how you actually brand a small startup when all you've got is your own time and skills.
Exactly. And I think from what I picked up from you that you would say, well, you did. You said that the reason why, well, the most important factor you think that shaped freelance programmers in its early years was simply, I think you said, being naive.
Well, because I've had no commercial education whatsoever, and I think things have improved for girls since those days, nobody told me what I couldn't do, and so I just went ahead and did it. I didn't realize that one just didn't do that. And the sheer excitement of making something happen. I'm very interested in art, and I think I'd love to be able to paint or sculpt or something like that. But actually building a business for the future is also very creative, and you get tremendous satisfaction as you make steps forward, and then you slip back, and then the recession comes, and all sorts of things happen. But you're slowly you're moving forward, and eventually we finished up. I don't know if we haven't got to the end of the book. We finished up with eight and a half thousand staff, which is, you know, a big corporation.
It's massive. We literally started from just you trying to find enough work to keep yourself busy.
Yes. But also, John, it was a sort of crusade for women. I was much more interested in the social implications as to what I was doing rather than any concept of making money. I really was certainly very naive commercially. I mean, I started off with checking whether the company should be a charity or whether it should be a company, and eventually realized it would never be respected unless it actually made a profit. So that was an early major decision and strategic one. So I've had a wonderful time. And I think one of the things I would like to say to would-be entrepreneurs is that it's not as easy as people pretend. I mean, the older I get, the better I used to be. But the fact is, it was enormously hard work for a long, long time. And in Britain, we have some government support of entrepreneurs. And I've really gone back to them and sort of said, you know, you don't explain how soul-destroying it can be to build a business. And very few people succeed. I think the figures are 1 in 7 of new projects, 1 in 7 of new companies survive.
Yeah. And with being naive, though, do you in any way think that it's almost necessary, especially when you're younger, like in your 20s or even early 30s and starting your first company? If you knew everything about how hard it was before you started, would you maybe have not started? So is it almost necessary to be naive so that you can just go all in and just be willing to take that?
It's something to do with character and purpose, I think, because I'm one of the people that the more you tell me I can't do something, the more I want to do it. So the fact that it's different, and you know, somebody famous sort of said to me, the most gratifying thing that any person can do is work at a project that with enormous effort stands a chance of success. If it's easy, I'm bored, I'm no good at it whatsoever. And the characteristics of entrepreneurs are very different from commercial managers. And one time as the company began to, as I handed over to professional managers, I admire so much what professional managers do. I used to even sort of think, now, what would a professional know? But actually, entrepreneurs are quite different. And we can do things and make things happen that are complementary to what the bureaucratic processes are. They're far more intuitive, perhaps. And, you know, I mean, I've done so many new things. And I think if I had remained in my first job, which was the public service, I would never have had that chance to make so many new things happen. So I've just had a wonderful life.
Yeah, you've had an amazing life. And so you left the public sector, but you were working in computers then. And then you left and went to the, like,
a little computer company, yes.
You went into the private sector. And then I understand that you realized like how much freer it was, faster moving and quicker paced, right?
Dave, John, that I should be paid so well to do something that I enjoyed so much. But I'm sure for entrepreneurs, we have to do something, not because that there's a market, but something that we ourselves enjoy, that we're prepared to put 24/7 input into. And it is. You know, I've worked weekends, I haven't had holidays and so on. It was a long struggle to keep going.
Right. And then there reached a point where you had to leave your job. You had to quit your job and start your own business. And I think it was actually a couple of years later, after starting your own business, that you actually realized you were indeed an entrepreneur, because somebody had told you that you were. And you're like,
what the word meant.
Can you just tell us maybe that story of like starting a business with knowing absolutely nothing and going for years and growing this business into something sort of tangible and real, and then being told that you're an entrepreneur and realizing it? Because that's intriguing. That's like,
I'm a workaholic, so I enjoy work. It's not something I do when I'd rather be doing something else. So when I started the business, I was so keen to provide work for women with children, and I measured success in terms of how much work was going through, not how much profit, because we weren't actually making much. The target originally was just to break even. And so I was not dashing around in all directions, but was responding very rapidly and intuitively to what was happening in the early computer world. And when somebody said, oh, Steve's a typical entrepreneur. Entrepreneur, I had to look it up in the dictionary. And of course, I am a social entrepreneur. I like doing new things. I like making new things happen. And I have now set up and taken into sustainability, I think it's 5 organizations, mainly charitable ones, but they have much the same problems without the commercial incentive.
Yeah. And so you had to look up the definition of entrepreneur. And then also, I believe around this time, there was, you guys apparently got into a discussion even of how, I believe it was how the word computer was spelt and program. Like you.
We were very, very early on in the industry. We would debate how to spell words.
That's amazing. Like, as I mean, I'm 37, right? I grew up with like the internet. I grew up with, I mean, I didn't have the internet till high school, but still, it's a very big part of my life.
In our application forms, we actually had a question, do you have access to a telephone? Because if they didn't have access to a telephone, they were not able to work for freelance programmers. And it's a very, very different world. When we wrote software, it was quite sophisticated stuff, and we worked in large teams, not when we started, but so, you know, after about 2 or 3 years, we'd got teams of 5. And after 5 years, we'd got teams of 20, I should think, working on different projects. And yet it was all paper and pencil, writing flowcharts, writing code, possibly in machine code. It might be in binary. And then sending it by mail to a computer center where it would be punched up, then onto paper tape or punch cards, then repunched in order to verify that process. All that prior to submission to the mainframe computer. And we had 2 turnarounds a week working like that. Now you've got 2 a second or something. I mean, it's it's a different world. But I was so lucky to be there at that time and able to sort of help mold the industry and have the freedom to try things myself. Fail many times because lots of things you tried didn't work. But when you're swift in decision making, that doesn't work. We'll do something else. If it works, we'll do more of it. If it works, we'll do it somewhere else as well. So that sort of instinctive, I mean, I'm remembered for my successes, and I have had some, but I've also had lots of failures, which people just forget. And I try to harvest from my errors and gain whatever it is that is possible from those failures and not repeat them.
Mm-hmm. And you say you're so blessed that you had the freedom to try all these things, but you weren't handed this freedom. You weren't given this freedom by any means. You definitely earned it. And it almost seems like you, I mean, you directed your life so that you had this freedom in front of you. I mean, you started selling software, and in 2015, that's what everybody does these days, right? But there literally was hardly a word for software at the time. And it's 50 years ago. I mean, it sounded completely mad. And I'm sure everybody told you you were mad. Not only
if they were polite. Usually they laughed at me, sometimes behind my back and sometimes overtly. Software was at that time given away free with the hardware. And they said, but Steve, you can't sell software. It's free. You can't charge for that. And certainly not as a woman and working from home. The Harvard Business Review described us as the company without offices, because for many, many years, we were just entirely home-based. So it was a very different sort of start. And I'm very proud, really, of having pioneered new forms of business, flexible working in all shapes and sizes, job shares, home working, teleworking, part-time working, working on trains, working at home. All these are things that I initiated and look now and sort of say, well, that's part of mainstream, which is as it should be. It's quite, I find it now quite difficult to do new things.
Yeah, the idea of remote work is now almost still seems like on the cutting edge, but you did it like 50 years ago at this point. It's amazing.
And one of the things that I suppose I'm so sad about in a way is not so much the remote working, but the opportunities for women who at that time had good degrees coming out of the universities, but were being blocked in the commercial world. And so I was sort of fighting for, not just for equal pay, though that was part of it, but fighting for opportunities. In a sense, freelance was the company that I myself would have liked to have worked with. And so I tried to make it that family-friendly environment that I would have liked and lots of other women clearly like. And it hasn't really taken off. It's still, I think, 10% of the UK workforce works from home. And largely that is by working one day a week at home. That's 20% of corporate people. So it's not really mainstream yet. And yet I was doing it 50 years ago and I sort of think, oh, you know, I have not succeeded there. It's all taken too long. But cultures are very strong. And the culture of, for women, positive discrimination did, in my mind, morph into diversity generally. And that's much more valuable, I think, worldwide. And that still has big things to do. And the branding that I had in the early company developed into, well, it was so strong that people tended to remember us for who we were rather than what we did. We had to actually soften up our emphasis, our values, in order to actually demonstrate that we provided quality services in this area at a good but honest price.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean specifically about how you had to soften up your branding?
Well, as when the company became professional, and I suppose that would be round about when we had about 1,200 people, I was still talking about the start. Yes, I started this company and we all worked from home and we all had babies. And I was really stressing the modesty of our conception, whereas we were competing in a world where we've been is not important. It's where we are and where we're going. And my colleagues really said to me, and I try to listen to people, we've got to present in a much more traditional and professional way. And although part of the presentational skills were always there, our reports were fine, we always dressed smartly, our phones were answered properly, and the quality of our work was good, we still had this, a lot of women together, and that had to go.
1,200 employees at that point. And you were still kind of sort of thinking of it as what you started, like by yourself and what you were trying to do.
I mean, I took the organization as chief executive up to about 1,000 and then brought in professional managers. And it was during those early phases that those people coming in were sort of saying, look, this has to change. And they were quite right, because they changed the branding to a certain extent, even to the extent of changing the name. They changed the employment policies. They changed the pricing, because my pricing was totally wrong year after year, decade after decade. There it goes.
Yeah. And so almost up to 1,000 you took it. And I believe that you said you were around, I think, less than 20 employees still. And you thought you knew so little about business that you actually looked at applying to business school at that point to figure it out, right? And then you went from 20 employees all the way up to almost 1,000 and still running it fully yourself.
Yes, it was delegated through, we went geographic regions at one time, and then we restructured and went by structure, scientific programming, commercial programming, and so on. So it had different forms, and certainly I wasn't day-to-day embroiled in everything. One of the sad things about entrepreneurism, I suppose, is that I went into business for this crusade for women. But because I do actually love software, I found it enormously exciting and satisfying. And, you know, I felt I could contribute there. But the first thing that, as an entrepreneur, I delegated was the actual software development. And I found myself very quickly concerned with recruitment, cash flow, dealing with the tax people, administration, the finance, the sending out the invoices, the collecting of the money. I mean, it was, and yet that wasn't what I wanted to do. So other people had that joy that I went into business for. And that seems to be fairly general, John, that you have the first thing you delegate is the big thing. And you're left with a lot of itsy bitsy things that nobody else will, that isn't a job in itself.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that if it was all to start right now with this day and age where we're at, do you think you would have still perhaps moved into software?
No, it's all a question of timing. I think if I'd have been 10 years earlier, I wouldn't have made it. If I'd been 10 years later, I wouldn't have made it. I was just there at the beginning of that growth curve, right at the start, and was one of the first sort of high-tech companies, service companies in the UK. And I was just very lucky. And a lot of business is timing. I think I mentioned somewhere in the book that I think in the first 10 years, I was asked whether I could write some software to recognize fingerprints.
Yes.
And I thought about it, you know, for several days and then eventually said, no, I don't think I can do that. And it took 40 years before that software actually was developed. And I mean, you know, had I had less sense, less nous, I would have kill the company by trying to do something that was so futuristic. So I think I had some sort of, people say that entrepreneurs are risk averse. Entrepreneurs take risks. I don't think I did take risks. I like to really know what I'm doing. I like to research what has to be done. I like to plan what I'm doing. And then perhaps feel free to experiment.
Right. But I mean, maybe to say that now, but risk averse, there's just through your story that I've gotten like thus far, it's like there's risk. I mean, to look at it now from a successful point, it maybe not, but at one point very early on, you and your husband had to remortgage your house. And
yeah.
Like, then it was like you were all in, like, this is what we have to do. And I think you even said that that was kind of the reason you took that risk, you took that leap, and you kind of set yourself up where you couldn't fail. You didn't give yourself a chance to fail. You just had to work and work and work.
I think that's quite insightful, actually, John. Yeah, it was a sort of total commitment. And with that, taking a mortgage on the marital home, I can remember talking to my dear husband and sort of saying, look, there's no guarantee that I'm going to be able to do this. And if we don't, you know, you and I are back in furnished rooms with a profoundly handicapped child already. We're talking about risks.
Yeah, and the remortgaging of your marital home.
I think for the sort of audience that might be coming out of the commercial bureaucratic field, what you have to remember about entrepreneurism is that it is an extension of yourself. And the values of a person, the values of an organization are extended to this corporation, so that, I mean, I was given so much as a child that I'm very keen to give back to society. And I took the company into co-ownership, and that was, you know, probably the biggest gift I ever made. I gave about a quarter of the company away to the staff. I joined something called the Percent Club, which was an early commercial gathering of largely main corporations to commit to giving 1% of pre-tax profits to charities in perpetuity. And my board sort of says, you know, how much are we giving now? And then, of course, we hadn't calculated it before. But, you know, I was doing things that are natural for me, and that I perhaps didn't need an MBA. I learned probably more from my colleagues than any professional courses that I went on.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because not all corporations are set up, even from day one, with the person who's sort of created this business with as an actual natural extension. Oftentimes it's created with just the idea of making money.
Yeah.
And those are probably where lots of the failure, I would think, comes from. When you make it a natural extension, right? It's,
yeah. I mean, I'm approached by people wanting advice, which I tend not to do that sort of mentoring. And they sort of say, well, I want to do this, that, and the other. And I need this salary, and I'm going to need a car, and I need a secretary in a small office. And they haven't thought at all about what they're going to sell or what somebody might be interested in buying. And it's very much egocentric. And to me, that doesn't seem a good start for a healthy entrepreneur. The Economist unit sort of says that in the 21st century, the businesses that will survive are the ones that actually are in tune with modern society, which is environmental, it's global. These are the things that, you know, you have to be or feel or want to be or want to feel if you're likely to make a success. I mean, it was 25 years before my company's paid a dividend. And, you know, that's a long, long time. It was a couple of years before I drew a salary, 1 year before I even drew expenses. So it's a very slow, painful stuff. Now, of course, it's wonderful. People just see that you know, major financial success, be able to be a major philanthropist in the UK. You know, very. And I try to bring into my philanthropy all that I have learned about business, direction, focus, monitoring, measurement, being prepared to cancel projects that are no good, slaughter a few sacred cows. And that means I'm still working, I'm still doing new things, I'm still, you know, got something to get up for each morning. And for most people in their 80s, you know, they're thinking about where shall I have lunch and do I play a little bit of bridge? And I have a much more active life than that.
It's awesome. How does it change now from, like you said, say with projects, like say 25 years ago, you were a big, big company and organization and you were, say, taking on new things personally and then within the company. How does that change now when you're working within foundations and how do you decide now what it is you want to do? And is that greatly different from what it was when you were still in the business?
I don't think it was all that different from business, in that an organization has to be business-like. And for example, in my philanthropy, I'm quite clear I only give to things that I know and care about. And there are really only two such things, information technology, which is my professional discipline, and autism, which was my late son's disorder. And I give to those sectors, full stop. And if you ask me for help with albino cats, you'll get a no from me. And I also have always been in research. I started off in the research station. I've always done new things. And similarly with my philanthropy, I don't really support projects, however valuable they may be, if they're not pioneering. So it's pioneering and at the same time strategic, by which I mean that if they succeed, and pioneering projects can and do fail. But if they succeed, make a real difference in the sea of needs that once you start working in the not-for-profit area, you just realize how unfair the world is. And philanthropists are really trying to sort of balance that a little bit. That, you know, yes, I'm very wealthy, I'm going to have a hot dinner tonight, but I also am aware that half the world is still hungry.
Yeah, and obviously with your story, it was...
Where you're expecting.
Pardon?
I don't think this conversation is going the way you expect.
No, it's much better. It's much better. But obviously with your story, the way it starts, and probably the first 25 years of it at least, it's very easy to get how you would see the world as very unfair. But then you built a business and you became very, very wealthy and, I mean, powerful in your ways, right? How did you keep that thought and within you of that the world is unfair and that there are many, many people that don't have what you have, even though you worked super, super hard for it and you very much deserved it? It was not given to you in any way at all. But lots of people lose that. Lots of people lose that vision that the world is unfair and that they should maybe use what they have now to try and help other people make good.
Well, I see a lot of wealthy people, entrepreneurs, once they have a success, change their standard of living so widely that they're still worried about money. This time they're worried about whether they can afford that bigger yacht or this round-the-world cruise or whatever it is. Whereas I think I have kept my feet firmly on the ground, partly because my husband, I think his nature would never have really allowed me to be extravagant. But also with a learning disabled child, I mean, our prime minister has a learning disabled child, and that keeps his feet on the ground because you can't really move away from all the other people who've got problems in their family. And I think that has helped me to keep some sort of stability.
And yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing that you did it. And it's impressive. I mean, now, especially at your age, like you said, most people are concerned with where they're going to have lunch or where's the next bridge game. And yet you still are concerned. And you have absolute freedom at this point to just leisurely enjoy your life. And yet you want to still push. You still want to give. And it's amazing. That strength, the energy.
I think it's something to do with legacy. How do I want to be remembered? And I'm not going to have a tombstone because my body is going for medical research. But if I had a tombstone, it would be my life had been worth saving as a child. I mean, that early start to face death and remember as a child that you were lucky to be alive. I think that means that I want to make a difference. I want to be remembered for having made good things happen. And not just, I'm very keen on efficiency and all things like that, but it's not so much doing things well, but doing good things.
Yeah, that's a nice way of saying it. And you did, you made that statement where you wanted to make sure your life was, had been worth saving. And now 75 years later, after you were five and you made it to London, that do you feel right now that you are happy with the legacy that you've left at this point?
I'm very happy. I mean, I have been very depressed in the past, but now I would say I was very happy. And to a certain extent, John, I've done what was in me to do. There's still little bits. I've just started a new 3-year project, and I sort of think, well, let's make sure that I've got my exit worked out there. But so I like doing, I'm still doing new things, and that's what I enjoy. But I have to temper my ambitions by my years. Mm-hmm.
So besides business, even, or if it can be business if you want, what do you, is the most magical sort of the thing that you are the absolutely most proud of that you have left behind as a mark in this world?
Well, the Financial Times in the UK has just announced a search for the 50 leading pioneers in business. And I hope to be one of those 50. That's how I would like to be remembered. Because I have pioneered software, I've pioneered women and flexible working, I've pioneered philanthropy in a commercial context. And so if I made that list of 50 leading business pioneers, I would be a happy bunny.
That's excellent. Dame Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us. You're right, the conversation didn't go as anticipated, but I think your story and your life has kind of showed us that that's typically how things work. Anyways,
can we get this wonderful book?
I would love to. Please, we've talked about it quickly. Just can you tell the audience what about your book?
Well, most things that are worth doing take months or years. And I spent 18 months, not full time, of course, writing my autobiography in the sense to try and capture the many of life's lessons that I have learned. And I've called it Let It Go. There's a pun on the IT for information technology, but also in a rather Buddhist sense, to realize that my management style is to ask for help, to show my weakness, to let it go, to be relaxed about things and not to be so burning passion that everything's got to be just right. So let it go.
Oh, I'm halfway through it as of last night, and it's an absolutely just breathtaking. Like you said, it's a story. It's like a refugee story. It's a story of a businesswoman and entrepreneurship. It's a story of philanthropy. It's a story of family. It's a story of so many things. And it's absolutely powerful and moving. So I recommend it to everyone to pick it up. And I will link to it for everyone in the show notes. So it's very, very easy to find.
Thank you, John.
So just thank you so much. I wish you luck in your new 3-year project you just took on. And just thank you for, I guess, doing all that you've done.
Thank you very much indeed, John. Take care.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Dame Stephanie, thank you so, so, so much for spending the time with me and for sharing with me and sharing with the world, with everything you've done. What you've been through is more than most people will ever go through in a lifetime. And you're so positive and you still devote yourself to, 3 charities right now. You're 81 years old. That's absolutely, absolutely beautiful and amazing and inspiring. And I truly, truly do thank you for that. As we mentioned, Dame Stephanie wrote a book called Let It Go. And she wrote it about 1.5 years ago. And I just read it. And it is an amazing book that I really, truly recommend that everyone read. And I would like to just end this off by reading you a short passage that I've read now 20 times, and it's really touched me in a way. And Dame Stephanie is thinking this back in her 20s before she went on this whole journey to make something really, truly amazing. And she's absolutely, absolutely succeeded at that. So I just want to read this passage. I would stop apologizing for myself, stop hiding myself, and while I was at it, stop feeling sorry for myself. I wanted whatever talents I had to be fully used, and the only person who was going to make that happen was me. I also resolved that I would stop congratulating myself on the little I had achieved in my life so far. Resting on one's laurels is the surest route to stagnation. Instead, I would keep aiming higher and higher, giving free rein to my instinct to ask restlessly, "Is this all that there is?" If I failed, so be it. But I would never allow myself to get into a position where I would curse myself for not having tried. That's amazing, Dame Stephanie, and I thank you so much. And please go out, grab her a copy of her book, read it, and share it with other people, because her story is one that needs to be shared and just needs to be just given out to everyone. And I think that it will resonate with a lot of people and help a lot of people. And I just truly, truly believe that this story needs to be shared more so than it already is. So that was absolutely a lot of fun. That was one of the most amazing conversations I've ever got to have. I didn't think I'd ever get to speak to Dame Stephanie personally. And when I found myself doing it at 7 a.m. one morning, I was in awe of the whole situation and also realizing that I'm also not the best interviewer in the world, but it's something that I want to strive for. And I could have canceled it, I guess, but following Dame Stephanie's words, I would just curse myself for not having tried. So thank you for that. This has been a lot of fun, as always. This has been a different episode, but I hope that you really did enjoy it a lot. Hacktheentrepreneur.com is the website if you would like to check it out. Until then, thank you again, and please keep hacking the entrepreneur.